Now, The Interpreter Show, with discussion, debate, and the latest information on all kinds of religious issues and topics.
This is The Interpreter Show on Interpreter Radio. The Interpreter Show is a production of the Interpreter Foundation, which is a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 organization, which is dedicated to the defense and explanations of the scriptures of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And it's a doctrine. It puts on symposium. It puts a weekly journal out with a new article, new scholarly article every week, which is absolutely free for you to read online at interpreterfoundation.org. And I'm happy to have you here. My name is Mark Johnson. I'm the host today. I'm joined by Matthew Bowen. Hey, Matt.
I'm still here.
Oh, I'm glad of that. Aloha, Matt. And then Carrie Milstein, are you still here, Carrie, with us?
I am.
Oh,
I am.
This is a treat.
Aloha also.
This is fun. And then we say aloha because Professor Bowen is at the University or BYU Hawaii, right, for his work. And
Carrie used to teach here. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome. You guys are just world travelers. I'm jealous.
And we were talking about Aaron Shade in the earlier hour. He also used to teach there.
Oh, that's right. I remember reading that.
Yes, indeed.
That's pretty cool. All right, so we are going to transition into our Come Follow Me lesson. I need to mention also our other sponsor, that is LDSAgents.com, which is a network of over 2,000 real estate agents that are Latter-day Saints, and they want to help you buy and sell your home. And it's crazy out there, and you need some help. And who better to call than LDSAgents.com? You can look them up on the internet, go check out their helpful site, and send them a message. Let them know what you're looking for. If you're looking for a big house, if you're upscaling or downsizing, just give them a call. And they'll be able to help you out. We had been talking with Matt and Carrie about books. I've got one more question that I forgot to ask Carrie before we get into our Come Follow Me section. I was talking to a friend of mine, Robbie Robbins, and he said that he spent some time with Carrie at the BYU Jerusalem Center way back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
And
back when we were students, yeah.
And he had a question he wanted to ask you about your books. And I quote, "How do you have so much time to do all these books?"
Well, I don't know that I have so much time. I mean, I am blessed to have a job where they want me to research, and so they give me some time for that. But it also ends up being a whole lot of early mornings and 20 minutes here and 20 minutes there. You just I've learned if I want to write a book, I have to say first thing in the morning, I'm going to ignore all my emails and all my phone calls and everything else and just write for half an hour or something like that, and not let anything interrupt me. And on a good day, then I have a hard time stopping that, and it'll go longer than that. But I don't have that much time, really, where you just got to fit it in and be efficient.
And from what I know about Matt, I think the same question would apply. I know you're plenty busy too.
Yeah, it's what Carrie. I relate a lot to what Carrie just said. You have to. It comes in those 20-minute spurts sometimes, where and you have to be strategic. That's all I can say.
That's a good word. I like that, strategic. So anyway, Carrie, Robbie says hi.
Tell him hi for me.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we've got our second hour of the Interpreter Show is dedicated to the upcoming, or one of the upcoming Come Follow Me lessons. And, we've switched over to the Old Testament now, which is going to be a lot of fun. I'm really excited about this. So this show talks about the second lesson, which is the creation. So So in the creation, we've got a number of texts, you know, which deal with this topic. We've got chapters out of Genesis. We've got chapters out of the book of Moses. We've got chapters out of the book of Abraham. And we're going to be looking at all of those. Matt, you want to give us a quick overview of at least the Genesis portions and maybe the book of Moses portions?
Yeah, we have the creation. You know, we've got a creation account in Genesis chapter 1 that breaks down into 6 days and takes us from the, you know, that phrase, which is has been debated long and has had a lot of ink spilled over it, that phrase, Bereshit bara, you know, Bereshit bara Elohim, in the beginning God created, or depending on what translation you read, when God set about to create the heaven and the earth, or the heavens and the earth, and then, you know, taking us all the way up to the beginning of Genesis chapter 2 with that seventh period that then corresponds to the Sabbath day. I think for me, one of the most enlightening things I've discovered in recent years, you know, it's not my discovery, but, you know, that it, as I've probed into this, are the connections here that ancient Israelites would have made between the creation account and the tabernacle. In chapter, you know, beginning about chapter 25 of Exodus, and the chapters thereafter, you know, that describes the setting up of the tabernacle and the, you know, a lot of things that, you know, pertain ritually to what was done in the tabernacle. It's been fruitful for me to see how the creation account is being told, especially in chapter 1, in a way that, and but also in chapter 2, in a way that brings us into the temple and the purposes of the temple, that, you know, helps to see creation as, you know, like the setting up of the tabernacle in Exodus, that the creation is kind of, you know, the establishment of God's created order mirrors something of a temple.
That's an interesting idea. I know a lot of scholars have written on that, especially mentioning how on the seventh day, God rested. And they point to the word rest and say that resting is something that a god does in a temple in the ancient Near East.
Yeah. In fact, that word Shabbat, you know, that verb, and I point out to Latter-day Saint students, this is a Hebrew word, you know, Shabbat, and the as a noun, and the related verb Shabbat, it means to not just to cease or to stop doing something, and it gets translated by English translators going back to near the beginning as rest. Mm-hmm. But it really means to come to the end of an activity, so that then you transition to a state of rest or nuach.
Interesting. I like that. What else is important for us to know about these chapters, Matt?
I think that when you read it in Hebrew, and this is one as a Hebrew student, that if you've taken Hebrew courses, you tend to read this text a lot.
Mm-hmm.
But it just when you read it out loud in Hebrew, it's just very pleasurable to say the words, and I think they would have that they got a lot of enjoyment not only out of reading the text but hearing it read.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember back to a few of the Hebrew classes I've had, you know, and we definitely went over the first chapter of Genesis a few times. It was fun to read, almost as fun as the Tower of Babel story.
There's repetition, but there's repetition with variation, as Gary Rensberg points out in some of the work that he's done. And it's that combination of repetition and variation. So you see the creation being described in very orderly process type terms, but then there is variation in the telling and the description of it, and it's really enjoyable.
I like that. That's a fun way to look at it. Carrie, why don't you give us a little intro to the Book of Abraham material that talks about the same period here, and maybe give us your thoughts or maybe some contrasts to what Matt's been talking about, or just your insights about this material.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So the Book of Abraham material is very, very similar to the Genesis material. It's actually, in most ways, more similar than the Book of Moses material, even though that's the Joseph Smith translation of Genesis. But we get a whole lot of new verses in there, and some of them really key, some really new stuff in the Moses material. But the Book of Abraham material is really the oldest. Right, so the Genesis material and the Book of Moses material date from at the earliest Moses, and then I would guess that the Genesis material has been through some redactors and gets changed or something. I don't know, edited in some way or another, but it can't be edited too much because the Book of Abraham, that's written by Abraham, who predates Moses by a ways. Mm-hmm. Now, it may also have had, I can't imagine that the Book of Abraham didn't also have some redactors or editors that went through it, and maybe they tried to sync the different accounts they were familiar with and make them look similar or something along those lines. I don't know, but it is it's the oldest, at least in its original base form, right? And I think that that's worth stopping for just a moment to talk about and recognize that As Latter-day Saints, our theology very much can accommodate the idea that we don't really have the original of any of these books of Scripture. We have later versions of them that have been edited, and that actually includes the Doctrine and Covenants and even the Book of Mormon, right? The Joseph Smith, the editions that were printed in his life, he was always kind of editing it just a little bit and making a change here or there, and same thing with the Doctrine and Covenants and the revelations that he gave us there. You're always going through this editorial process. So as Latter-day Saints, we understand that Joseph Smith told us it was happening with the Bible, and we can assume that it happened with the Book of Abraham as well, or else it's unique. If it didn't happen, it's the only book of Scripture it didn't happen with. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's something important to recognize as we get into creation and just Old Testament in general, there are a couple of things that are worth recognizing. One, we don't have the text that Moses wrote the way he wrote it himself. We don't have the text that Abraham wrote the way he wrote it himself. We have texts that have gone through editorial glosses, and they very well may be inspired editors, just like Mormon and Moroni were inspired editors that give us, we only get Alma through Mormon, right, and so on. So there are inspired editors, but it also highlights another important point, which is this, that actually none of our Scripture, remember Joseph Smith calls the Book of Mormon the most correct book. He doesn't say completely, fully, 100% correct with no flaw in it. Mm-hmm. And in fact, its authors tell us that there are flaws in it. The problem is that they're trying to convey perfect gospel principles with an imperfect mind using an imperfect language. And then we try and pick that up with our own imperfect mind and our own imperfect understanding of language. And it's just not going to be able to convey those perfect gospel principles unless we have the Spirit with us.
That's true.
So that's really the key.
Yeah, and in the case of the Bible, we've had, numerous translations built upon translations. So we've got, that that filter as well. We've got to get the Scriptures through.
And so we know that the scriptures, in the way that they are written or printed in a book, have some flaws in them. We're very aware of that. But if you have the Spirit with you when you read them, then we overcome those flaws. Right? That's the key. The way Elder Oaks once put it, when he was Elder Oaks, not President Oaks, is he said that the scriptures were not our ultimate source. They were what he called the penultimate source, which means like second to last. That the ultimate source is the revelation that, or the Spirit that is with you as you read them. They open you up to the Spirit to teach you the truths that they were trying to convey, to teach them to you in perfect truth. So as we go through the Old Testament,
really,
I think it's important just to keep that in mind.
That's what the whole restoration's about right there, what yeah. Kerry is saying. That's really, in essence, a big part of what the restoration, where it puts us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just key to understanding any scripture, but I think especially the Old Testament. Now, if we're going to summarize the Book of Abraham creation story in general, first of all, let's also say we need to know something of the story of the translation or the publication of the Book of Abraham. So in my book, Let's Talk About the Book of Abraham, I go through this history in more detail than we'll go here. But we need to understand that when Joseph Smith published it, he wasn't done publishing it, and he wasn't done translating it. He may have translated more than what we currently have, and he may not. There's some debate about that, and I don't think we can tell academically. I don't think we can tell, but there's no doubt he intended to publish more. He said it. John Taylor said it in the Times and Seasons, the same newspaper it was published in, that more was going to be published. He just didn't get around to publishing it. So, in fact, chapter 5 just ends still in the middle of the creation story. It feels like it ends in the middle, and that's because it does. We don't have the whole thing. So we also need to know that there's a little bit of an abrupt ending here. But if we're going to look at some differences, I think there are two really key differences between the Abraham creation account and the Genesis. As I said, they're mostly the same. You do get some Hebrew words thrown into the Abraham account that is probably the result of Joseph Smith having studied Hebrew and recognizing these words and inserting them in there. But those aren't the big differences. The two big differences are the agent, the actor. So in Genesis, you have, third person, God, all right? In fact, let's compare Genesis, Moses, and Abraham for a second. In Genesis, you have third person singular. He, God, created, right? In Moses, for the first quite a while, you have first person singular. I, God. And the interesting thing is that you get the switch to he, God, when you get the fall. And so I think literarily, it's a tool. And suddenly, we're no longer hearing from God himself because we're cut off from the fall and we're going to interact with God through intermediaries. So suddenly, it's he, God. I think that's a really interesting literary element of the book of Moses. So you've got third person singular in Genesis, first person singular in the book of Moses, and you have first person plural. Third person plural. So I'll get my grammar right. You've got third person plural in the book of Abraham, where it says to begin with it's first person, and then it goes to third. So it starts out with, then the Lord said, let us go down. And then it switches to third person. And they went down at the beginning, and they, that is the gods, organized and formed the heavens and the earth. And you keep getting this, they, the gods, and the gods called the light day, and the darkness they called night. And so there's a plurality here. And it's interesting because this follows right on the heels of an Abraham chapter 3, where Abraham is shown that there are many noble and great ones, and that God said to Abraham he was among those noble and great ones, and then there was one among them like unto God, and this would be Christ, who says to the others, we will go down and we'll prove them, we will organize, and so on. And so you have this plural group planning the creation in Abraham chapter 3, and it's clear that the group is God overseeing it, but led by Christ with other noble, free mortal spirits. who are with him, and that must be the group that's being referred to in chapter 4, because in chapter 3, that's who's planning the creation. In chapter 4, we see the creation happening. So you've got this plural group bringing about the creation. And then you have what, to me, is one of the most intriguing phrases in anything about the creation ever, and that is that several times in the Book of Abraham creation account, you have them watching until they were obeyed. So, for example, in verse 10, chapter 4, verse 10, and the gods pronounced the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters pronounced they great waters. And the gods saw that they were obeyed. Or in other places it says they watched until they're obeyed. And so you have this, different people debate about what the meaning of that is. Is it that everything has its agency? Right? So even like we talk about, even the dust obeys God, well, it has agency or not? Or is it that they set a process in motion and they watched until the process finished? And there are different ways people interpret that phrase. But I find it really interesting that it talks about these elements obeying them, and sometimes they're waiting to see that they are obeyed.
And it's interesting that those moments where it says they watched or watched until they were obeyed, they correspond in places in Genesis to where we see God saw that they were good. And it's very kind of brief or laconic. And here it's, you know, it gives us a lot of insight into what that concept of good would mean in terms of, you know, how the creation unfolded.
Right. Yeah, that you're right. That is the kind of semi-corresponding or semi-equivalent phrase in the Genesis or Moses accounts.
Very interesting. I like
and
that. Oh, go ahead,
Mike. There's another couple interesting things here too. I know Carrie's noted this, but the instead of the word create in the Genesis account,
yeah,
in the Book of Abraham, you get that word organize.
Yes.
And not only that, but then you've got this word counsel. You know, that the gods took counsel together and that they made decisions, and that really, you know, as Elder Ballard has really sort of got us thinking as Latter-day Saints a lot more about the principles of counseling, taking counsel together. It helps us see how not only the family and church organization here on earth mirrors the family organization in heaven and you know the divine process of counseling and making decisions. And how those are really divine processes.
Yeah, on earth as it is in heaven, our councils mirror at least something that is going on in the premortal and currently still, as we could call it, supramortal, or but the heavenly realms, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we can. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say I had a quick question for Carrie. You mentioned how this cuts off so abruptly in Abraham 5.
Yes.
I know John Gee has talked about, he thinks that there's about, we have about, I think, 25%, he estimates, of what Joseph Smith originally translated of the Book of Abraham. Where do you come down on that?
So I think it's very possible. I'll tell you, and I go through this a little bit in my book, Let's Talk About the Book of Abraham, but I'll tell you the source for that. At least this, I think this is where John is getting it from, and he and I have talked about it. Maybe I'm forgetting some other data he has on this, but I think it's coming from this source. There's a really interesting account by Anson Call. And so we have to put on our historian's hats to be able to assess this account, right? So, and the account, just even in the way it's recorded, is a little bit problematic because Anson Call has a journal that he writes, and it's after, you know, these most of it's written after the fact, although he seems to be relying on some earlier records that he's written, but it's hard to tell. And he has a son that's helping him write these. And in most of the versions of that journal, the paragraph that we're going to talk about isn't there. And I had to go up to the church archives to puzzle this through because I kept seeing versions of this where it's not there. And then then suddenly you get versions where it is. And it seems like he must have gone back at some point. And this is a journal that he had to kind of worked on for his publishing for his descendants. So it's the publications of this. Most of them don't have it, but at some point he must have added a couple of things. Someone should go through and compare and see if he added other things. But the only, I'm not an Anson Call expert, so I'm not going to go through all of his journals and compare to see what differences there are. But in some versions he has added, but it was he apparently with the help of his son that added this paragraph. And in this paragraph he says that when he is in Far West, so this is 1838, he's in Far West, and he goes to the store in Far West, and the two boxes arrive. And the storekeeper says, oh, Brother Joseph will be much pleased with these. Would you help me, Brother Call, carry these over to him? And so they do, and Joseph is in a meeting. But they come in, and Joseph is excited. And they open these boxes that have just arrived, and in one of them is what he calls the new translation of the Bible. We call it the Joseph Smith translation. So he's been waiting for those documents that he's created to be shipped in. And the other is the translation of the Book of Abraham. Now, just that in and of itself makes you think there must be a bit. I don't know why it would need a whole box when it would be about four pages. So if it were just what we had, right? So maybe a little bit more than four, but not a lot. So then Anson records in his journal that Joseph said, oh, Brother Call, sit down. You will enjoy this. Sit down and listen to us. And then he says, that they read out loud from the Book of Abraham, Oliver Cowdery Lee reading until his voice gave out, and then another brother read, altogether taking about 2 hours. Now, you can sit down and read at a very slow pace the current text of the Book of Abraham and read it in about half an hour. So that's, I think, where Dr. Gee is getting this 25%, because that would mean then that we have about 25%. But the account's a little problematic, not only that it's later reminiscent that he's adding it in, but also that he said the first person to read until his voice gave out was Oliver Cowdery. And Oliver Cowdery, at this point, is excommunicated and not with Joseph Smith and not in Far West. So it couldn't have been Oliver Cowdery that read, so he's at least misremembering that. So that gives us a question as to what to do with this account. All right, so as a historian, I'd say, okay, I'm not going to take it fully 100% at its word, but at the same time, I suspect, I mean, and he's remembered this later, so he may, he's going to remember something's wrong, and he obviously has remembered something wrong. But at the same time, I doubt he's just making this up. He has no motivation to make it up. There's nothing he's trying to prove, no reason to make it up. And so it's easy to misremember who was there, and it's also probably easy to misremember exactly how long it took, and maybe he didn't have a, look at his clock and then look, he said about 2 hours, right? But still, I doubt you confuse 2 hours with half an hour. That just doesn't seem like it's going to happen. And so that's pretty good evidence that he has translated more than the material that we have today. I don't know that we can say for sure. The account is problematic and so on, but I think we can say it's quite likely. I think that's a fair historical assessment of this. It is quite likely that he had already translated more than what we have today. There's some other evidence that would argue against that, and that's why I think we can't take it too, as ironclad. But it still is evidence that needs to be taken into account.
That's about where I think I fall on the topic, too. And I think I believe that at least the substance of the Anson Call Journal.
Yeah.
If some of the details are wrong. And yes, full disclosure, Anson Call is my third great grandfather. So,
well, there you go.
You know,
and my sister is her last name is now Call, and she's also now married into that family. So. We have great respect for Anson Call. I really do. It's certainly worth respecting.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to diss what he's saying.
Not at all. I understand the arguments, and I think there's also other instances that the prophet is taught things that he says were from the Book of Abraham or from Abraham's time that aren't in. Either the Genesis or the Joseph Smith translation or the Book of Abraham. And it seems to me, and I wrote about this in my 2017 paper on the Book of Abraham, that, you know, a likely source would be from this unpublished portion of the manuscripts.
Yeah. Yep.
There's a handful of things out there that the prophet has taught. You know, a little bit about, I'm trying to pull it up on my phone, but my phone's being problematic. But I guess we don't need to go into that.
He does say a few times, like he teaches a couple of things. He says, as are written on the papyrus that, as was written by Abraham and is on the papyrus in my office. Mm-hmm. You're like, hey, wait, that's not in the Book of Abraham. So at the very least, he knows more of what's on the papyri. And again, that suggests that he's translated more. But, right.
But
that's all
not,
we can say.
It's not evidence, though. I think I would say that there's certainly room in the discussion for there to be more. But, you know, it's not conclusive, you know, positively or negatively.
Yeah.
You know, on that point. So. All
right. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Matt, does that get your question?
Yeah, I appreciated that. Yeah, I knew that John wasn't just pulling that out of the air.
No.
He'd done the math. I was just trying to, wondered where Kerry came down with respect to what, the calculations that he'd run on that.
Yeah. I'll tell you, John Geet never pulls anything out of the air.
No, he does not. He's when we were talking about epistemology, he's the one that really helped me to understand, the importance of, what do you know and how do you know it?
Yeah. Yep, and know your data well, but know what it can and can't do. Yeah.
Know the limitations.
Mm-hmm. I think that we're lucky in the church to have him. He's such a careful scholar.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do we need to know then about the creation accounts? Are they literal? Is it myth? where do you guys fall on that?
Well, I'll tell you, I end up teaching creation accounts a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Because I teach Old Testament and I teach Pearl of Great Price, and both of them have creation accounts. And so that question you just asked is something that I'm asked all the time. And I've been teaching Old Testament since 1994, right? I mean, this is a number of years now.
Mm-hmm.
And I get asked that all the time about things, the creation account in general, all sorts of things in the creation accounts, things to do with the fall, and a host of other questions. And this is really kind of my standard answer. There are lots of things that I can't tell if they are literal or not. Now, I think that, God could, well, we'll come back to that in a moment, all right? There's certainly a literal element, but we'll come back to that in a moment. But there are lots of things I can't tell if they're literal or not, but they are always symbolic. Always symbolic. Even when they're literal, they're symbolic. And I think the more important thing is to figure out what is the symbolism. What does God want us to learn through the symbolism? So now let's go back to that, talking about whether they're literal. I mean, there's an element of this that has to be literal. The question is, what is God trying to do here? God could, I would guess, through his prophets, give us any number of kinds of creation accounts. He could give us, a geophysical creation account. He could give us a subatomic creation account. He could give us the astronomical creation account. And it's interesting to me that, for example, when Moses asks him, in Moses chapter 1, Moses asks him, tell me basically why and how. But he says, by what? Why and by what you made these things.
Mm-hmm.
And with all the different kinds of explanations God could give him as to how he creates it, he says, by the word of my power or by my only begotten Son, right? His answer is, well, by Christ I created these. So that's telling us, this of all the things God could tell us, that's what he wants us to know about the how. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't explore the other stuff. We should, explore everything with every kind of avenue of learning we have, but keep in mind that for God, that's the most important element for us to learn. So, again, as we look at this creation account, and we have to be mindful that none of the creation accounts are identical, including if we're going to include the temple creation account, it's not identical with these. Three of the four of them we get from Joseph Smith, and yet those three are all different from each other, sometimes in order, sometimes in all sorts of other things, right, in the order of what's created when. And so it's clear that God is trying to give us an account that will teach us some things that he wants us to learn. So there, I think, is the point we need to begin at. I don't know how much of this is literal. There's certainly some potent symbolism that we can talk about in a moment if you want. But what we need to keep in mind is God wants us to learn something. He's presented this in this way so that we will learn something. What should we learn? And there are tons of answers to that. It's not just this is what he wants us to learn. It's just this one thing. Lots of different answers to that, but I would approach it that way rather than trying to figure out, okay, what kind of a model is this? I'd just say, what does God want me to learn from this?
Yeah, that's a really good way to look at it. I think that I personally lean that, you know, I challenge my own assumptions on this and, you know, challenge the assumptions behind the question and say, why does it have to be one or the other? Why can't it be both at the same time?
Right.
You know,
yeah.
But
there's certainly a literal aspect to this.
Really,
I
really endorse what Kerry is saying about this. That we need to, I mean, when we talk about how the Lord teaches us, what's the Lord's way of teaching?
Mm-hmm.
It is through symbolism.
Yeah,
and we have to see, you know, everything on one level is at least one level as being symbolic. When God revealed, you know, when he gave Abraham his revelation, when he gave Moses his revelation, when we have the ancient Israelite custodians of this material, they weren't evolutionary biologists, they weren't astrophysicists. God was speaking to them according to their own understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you get President Kimball, I'll just give you one example here, talking about how he said that the story of the rib in Genesis 21 and 22 is symbolic. But when you know, he said it wasn't literal, it's symbolic. But when you start to unpack the symbolism of the rib and, you know, the connection of the rib to life and life-giving from Samaria to ancient Israel and the concept of the how of this relates to the temple. David Calabro has made a really interesting connection, I think, with the rib.
I'm glad you brought this up. Yeah, go ahead.
In connection with the side chambers of the temple. And, Kerry, be familiar with this one. I was really struck when reading the Egyptian story of the story of the shipwrecked sailor. You have that temple there whose, you know, two sides are in the water, and, you know, one of the, you know, the guest pair, and the idea of the rib there.
Yeah.
You know, that there's a connection between, you know, ribs and bodies and vital organs and the temple.
And yeah,
that
and
the,
life
the
and
woman
creation.
Isn't created from the rib, she's built from the rib. And there's just, you know, there's it's very, you know, there are some really fruitful things, I think, that we can understand from just the dense, tightly packed symbolism
President Kimball also drew on, and I don't know if he knew he was drawing on, that some ancient rabbis had said this as well, but also that the rib connoted that they were side by side, not one above the other, and so on. So, I mean, you see that how there are different layers and levels of symbolism there.
Yes. And so, you know, if we're looking at this to be a cosmology from the perspective of an astrophysicist, we're asking the text to do something that it was never intended to do. But then, but if we allow the Lord to speak to us as we do in the temple through the symbolism that's there, and to teach us the principles of the gospel, then we're really open, I think, to getting the instruction that He would give us.
So maybe I could just walk us through a little bit of at least one little bit of set of symbols that I think, you know, Matt talked about God talking according to their understanding of the way they would get things.
Yes.
I think we can just see a couple of symbols that will help us understand some of how that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So in the ancient Near East, whether it be Egypt or Mesopotamia or really anywhere throughout the ancient Near East, the idea of creation is not that it's ex nihilo, it's out of nothing. It's that there was material already there that needed to be organized.
Mm-hmm.
And typically that material is symbolized by water. They would call it chaos, or that's how they, you know, we translate what they would call it in Egyptian. There are lots of different things you can call it, but it's chaos, meaning unorganized stuff. And water is the symbol of that, and that makes sense, right? Water, we're not talking on the subatomic level, just on the way they would deal with water. Water can take whatever shape. It doesn't have a form of its own. It takes whatever shape of whatever you put it in, right? It doesn't have a shape of its own. And then creation is, so, for example, the Egyptians will call the period before creation, they'll call it the before there were two things. I mean, everything is the same. It's all this big primordial soup. It's this big watery chaos. And creation is when one thing is organized in a way that it's different than all of the other stuff. And that's symbolized by dry land coming out of the water, right? And so, again, for the Egyptians, they'll see this when the Nile floods and then it starts to recede. Ah, you see dry land, that's creation beginning. But it's this idea that creation comes symbolically out of watery chaos, and dry land appears. So with that in mind, then if we start to look at, say, Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, where it says, the earth was without form, no form, right? It's void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. The deep what? This is deep water.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's what it is. It's water. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. Suddenly, that's the first thing, right? Now there's something that's different than everything else. But then, of course, we're going to start to divide the water from the land and so on. And he makes a firmament, and that firmament, you know, you're tempted to read that and think, oh, that's dry land, but it's a firmament that divides the waters which are under from that which is above. And suddenly, if you were to draw that, you would end up drawing it exactly where the Egyptians and Mesopotamians do, which is where you've got a sphere with water all around it, because the sphere is the organized material, and it's watery chaos all around it. And so if you have that kind of creation in mind, you suddenly see that the language of Genesis 1 speaks to people who understand creation through that set of symbols. It's using the symbols they were familiar with to tell them that there was someone, as is said more explicitly in Abraham chapter 3, there was someone, individual, group, whichever creation account we're going to look at, who went to the unorganized, chaotic material and organized it into something that it wasn't chaotic. It was organization. It was creation, we could call it. And he just tells that story using symbols that they get, and sometimes we struggle to get.
I think that's one of the difficulties we have as modern readers. That, you know, we're not plugged into the ancient mindset. We're not familiar with the way that they understood the universe, you know, or the structure that you talked about, Carrie, about, you know, the, you know, ancient model of cosmology.
Yeah.
And
cosmogony, both. And we're also not as symbol-oriented as they were. In fact, I would say this is one of the big keys, if we're going to be here at the beginning of talking about the Old Testament, one of the biggest keys for understanding the Old Testament is to get symbol-oriented. We live in a world that's increasingly divorcing itself from symbols. And I think at least part of the reason why is that we're in a very legalistic world. So we want, you know, A to have, point A to have one meaning and one meaning only.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not how symbols work, and we're increasingly uncomfortable with that. We have to become very symbol-oriented. I think when it says that God speaks to man in their own language and according to their own understanding, but that's not just whether it's Portuguese or English. It's also the way you're used to communicating, and the Old Testament peoples were used to communicating through symbols. And as Matt said, that's God's preferred way to teach. And so I think we will see a lot of symbols, both symbols in the text, but symbolic actions, symbolic historical events. We just need to start thinking in terms of symbols. So, in fact, I think I'm going to... I need to write some of this stuff down to help people get this. Sorry. So, Matt, you and I have to write something about this sometime.
We got this. We'll do it.
All right.
I'll write
the introduction for the book.
All right.
We'll get started. We have this idea of creation versus non-creation that's very heavily influenced by Platonism. And Middle Platonism, Neoplatonism, this idea of just sort of non-existence, and then the idea of creation being, it coming into actual existence from non-existence. And that wasn't the ancient Israelite idea of creation at all. Something could physically exist, but it wasn't organized or created until it had its purpose. It had to be functional. Once something had its function that within the real world, now it's created or organized.
Matt, are you going back to the...
It's ready to go.
You going back to the John Walton book?
Yes.
Excellent. That's one I wanted to mention the first hour as well. Go ahead with this, though.
It's that idea. Like Carrie's been talking about, we got to start thinking in terms of how the ancients thought about things. And, life for them was very... We live in a world where we have so much more leisure time, compared to what they had. They had to do so much in terms of subsistence living just to get through the day. And we have so many things that, give us leisure time because of the work that they remove from our lives. So, we're not that far away from that, really. I mean, you look back at the time of the prophet Joseph Smith and the early Latter-day Saints, they were still in that, things hadn't really changed all that much from, many centuries going back in terms of the work required just to get through the day. So, we got to recapture some of the mentality of our ancestors and thinking in terms of the functional symbols that they were familiar with. And that's why Jesus taught in parables, right? I mean, he was speaking to them and using the symbols and language of the everyday that they were very familiar with.
And parables are just extended symbols. Parables and allegories, that's all they are.
Yeah.
So we really shouldn't be surprised then if these same kind of methods of teaching and, explaining things show up in the creation accounts, Brent. Because that was their bread and butter. That was their everyday lives.
We should be surprised if they didn't.
Yeah, exactly. And so we shouldn't also expect that or expect our creation accounts to match up with what we view as a scientific or astronomical creation, because that's not what they were writing about.
And yet, it is fun to see when Carrie mentioned that none of these ancient Near Eastern creation accounts had any concept of creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. And yet the prophet Joseph Smith, when he's teaching that matter cannot be created or destroyed, he's 100% right on that from both the ancient perspective on it and from the modern, astrophysics perspective.
Yeah.
Let me just add to that creation can't be destroyed matter can't be destroyed or created, but can be lost, and I call that the car keys principle.
That's my children and the car keys for sure.
Yeah, yep. almost didn't make it to the show today because of that very thing.
So, and this is a little bit of a segue or a tangent, but only a little bit. I'm actually really thinking we need to get a lot of these kinds of ideas out there to help people as they go to understand the Old Testament. So I'm gonna kind of give, and you'll decide never to have me on the show again, but I'm gonna kind of give the Interpreter Foundation a little challenge on this, that maybe you could pull through all the different articles and podcasts you have and create a little page somewhere that just is like aids for understanding the Old Testament. And I've got a really simple little website called outofthedust.org, but I'm going to do the same thing to have just aids to understand the Old Testament, where we can link to different articles and different things people have done to say, okay, well, people need to understand symbols. Oh, like Don Perry talked about symbolic action in this publication and so on. And we can put together some things that will help people understand the Old Testament.
I like it. We're on it.
We've got.
Go ahead.
We've got Jack Welch over here in Hawaii too, and I don't know if they've got Old Testament Central running, but you know that might be another place to get this going. This needs to be done.
Yeah, yeah. Because people, I mean, I think that we, as we said earlier, people really want to understand, or they really want to do, come follow me. And probably the most daunting of all the years is going to be this year. And yet there's good stuff out there to help people. We just need to kind of collate it for them. So we're on this. We're gonna do this.
I think this will be the year. I've talked with some of the Book of Mormon Central folks that I'm going to spearhead the Book of Habakkuk Central. So,
oh, perfect.
Got to start somewhere.
That'll be a great big giant website.
Oh, tons of resources. Brand new translation, all the works. I really am looking forward to seeing what we can get out of this year, though. There are so many popular, podcasts and, publications coming out, video series on YouTube and other platforms. There really is an explosion of interest in, following the Come Follow Me program, and that's one of the reasons why I'm excited to be part of the Interpreter Show, is to, help people along that path, give them, point them in different directions about, finding access to new information about, topics on the Old Testament, like some of the issues that we have with creation. So it's an exciting
thing. Sounds great. That sounds fantastic.
All right, we've got a few minutes left before we're going to be played out. Any other thoughts before we?
Maybe I have one more. I know I've been talking a lot, but maybe I can give you just one more.
By all means.
We could talk, like we said, evolution and physics and all sorts of stuff. But in many ways, what you need to know about the creation, and this goes back to what I said, God chose what things he wanted us to know. In many ways, everything you need to know about the creation, or the most important thing you need to know about the creation, is in the first few words. In the beginning, God.
Yes.
Right? And those four words is the key element. We need to understand that this begins and ends with God, and there are tons of exciting and wonderful things to study. The symbols, ancient Near Eastern symbols, evolution, geology, whatever you want to study. But remember, it begins and it ends with God. It is his plan that he has put into place to exalt us, to bring us home to be with him in a higher, holier state. And that's the part that we can't forget.
No, exactly, to bring about that's his work and his glory.
Yeah.
And I would just add to that, Bruce and Marie Hafen have pointed this out, that the Adam and Eve are, where the humankind comes into this, and it's they're who we encounter in the endowment in the temple, and the story of their creation, fall, and redemption is the story of our creation and fall and redemption as married couples and as families. And again, at the center of all of it is Jesus Christ, as Carrie so nicely pointed out earlier, and by my word, when Moses asked how, by what was this creation carried out, it's all through Jesus Christ. His creating, but his redeeming us from the fall. He's the Redeemer, and it all revolves around him.
Indeed, without him, we don't have anything.
Absolutely.
This has been the Interpreter Show. I'd like to thank Matt and Carrie.
You're listening
we'll see you next
K-Talk
week.
Radio,
thank you.
KBJ 1640 AM.